Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why an Oscar-winning sound designer relies on real-world sound to build believable fantasies.
And the latest strategic maneuvers in the ongoing battle over Colorado River water rights.
But let's begin this morning at the state capitol, where lawmakers will be taking the floor and heading to one all-important committee to see what proposed legislation will make it out of the chamber in the weeks to come. Here to fill us in on all of the happenings to come this week at the state capitol is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Good morning to you, Howie.
Good morning. Another day in paradise.
So it sounds like mainly floor action this week, not many committees meeting.
The House and Senate have a schedule. Essentially, they take the first couple of weeks to take bills through committees, and I'm sure they say that they thoroughly examine them, although some bills only get 3-4 minutes apiece. And then at this point in the session, each House takes what is passed, with a few exceptions that we'll talk about, and takes it to the floor for floor debate. So all the lawmakers who didn't get a chance to look at it because they weren't a member of the committee now get a chance to debate it, talk about it. And more to the point, they find out, are the majority votes there to put it forward and send it over to the other chambers? And that's what pretty much this week is full of. It's taking all of the bills that came out of committee, some of the stuff we've heard about on the air here, mm-hmm. and say, is this going to survive?
Okay. All right. So as we head into that, let's talk about a few of the bills that will be discussed this week. One bill you're watching is going to be revived as one to do with shielding utility companies from liability in the case of a wildfire. And in the case that wildfire may be started by that utility company's equipment, as we've seen happen in other wildfires around the country. Tell us a little bit about where this stands now.
Well, right now the bill is, shall we say, it's sleeping, or it's perhaps in a light coma. This is a proposal that was raised by the utilities who say, well, look, if we follow certain plans, we shouldn't be held liable if, in fact, our power lines touch trees. And as you know, power lines sag in the summer because mm-hmm. the heat of the wires and everything else. Or if we don't turn off the power in a high wind event. And so they say, well, if we follow our plan, why should we get sued? Well, the problem becomes, who does pay for the damages? If in fact, my home is burned up because in the case of California with Pacific Gas and Electric, here it might be Arizona Public Service or SRP. Well, then who is liable? Do I go to my insurance company? And the insurance company is going to say, well, wait a second. It wasn't the fault of the homeowners, it wasn't the fault of the insurance company. And so they want to get the ability to go ahead and go back to the utility company and say, you caused this problem, you should be responsible for it. And in cases where you did things like failing to turn off the power during a high wind event, you should be subject to punitive damages for an intentional action. Mm. The bill failed this past week. I think a lot of folks were concerned about liability. The other fact is we have a provision in the Arizona Constitution, almost unique to Arizona, that says you cannot limit the rights of people to sue and collect for damages. So now they have to figure out a way of bringing it back to find out if can it get votes, and B, can you make it constitutional?
Can you make it constitutional? One bill that you're also watching for, this is HB 2926. This would make some pretty significant changes to ACCESS, which is, of course, Arizona's Medicaid program. We're hearing a lot about Medicaid on the federal level right now. What would this do on the state level?
Well, ACCESS officially covers everybody up to 100% of the federal poverty level. About a decade ago under Jan Brewer, they said, look, there's federal money out here, and we can cover people up to 133% of the federal poverty level and do it at very minimal expense. There's a lot of concerns that the feds are going to cut back on that money. And so one of the things will be a trigger that the feds cut back, all those expanded programs go away. But it would also add things like a requirement to work at least 20 hours a week to get this state-provided Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. Maybe doing volunteering, participates in workfare requirements. And then a few other things. There would be some exceptions. For example, if you're at least 64, if you're pregnant, if you're medically incapable of working. But it raises the question of, is Medicaid an insurance policy, and should you have to work for that if you are in fact eligible. And that becomes a perennial philosophy around here. We've seen the same thing with food stamps.
Yeah.
And at what point do you decide, okay, you know, people should be required to put in some effort on their own behalf?
This sounds like it could be very affected by what happens at the federal level too, right?
Oh, this is definitely the case, because what's funny is, I hate to use the word funny, is that while Trump has said, oh, we're not going to cut Medicaid, and meanwhile, Elon Musk is running around saying, well, we've got to cut Medicaid because, you know, you can nibble around the edges on all of these programs that his Department of Government Efficiency is going after, but it's the big programs like Medicaid, like Medicare, which is a different program, like Social Security, where all the money is. And unless you're going to make some changes there, in some ways, I know that they're saying there's hundreds of millions of dollars that we've saved. I'm not particularly buying it, but if you want to save the real money, those are the programs.
All right, last minute for you here, and one more bill I want to bring up that might get, you know, some chatter this week. This would allow golf courses to let people, you know, BYOB. Where's this coming from?
Well, this is an interesting question, because right now state law says if you want to let people bring their own booze, you have to have a certain state kind of license. And in fact, it prohibits an outdoor event like that from doing that. What happens is that people like, you know, what happened at the Open is you have your own license and you cannot bring other people's booze in. Mm-hmm. So this would say to a golf course, if you want to, you may allow people to bring in their own booze. Now, I don't know why a golf course would want that, because, you know, you're selling, you know, make money off of what you sell. But it raises a fascinating question of, once people are just wandering around with open bottles that they brought in, and you know, vodka and rum, and making their own, you know, cocktails and everything else, you've got not just rowdy patrons, but then you've got this fascinating question of, you know, if you want to call it golfing while intoxicated. And Lord knows, I've seen some people at some golf courses where it's hard to tell whether that slice was due to just bad golfing or maybe a little bit of inebriation.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens on that front as well. Lots to happen at the Capitol this week. Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
As Arizona's record dry winter continues, Western Water managers are quietly preparing for what many have called a nuclear option in the ongoing battle for who gets what from the quickly drying Colorado River. Seven states are locked in a standoff right now over who should use less water from the river as climate change continues to dry it up. They are facing a 2026 deadline to create new rules to govern it. And last month, Arizona rocked the boat by proposing a state budget that included millions to pay for a court battle over Colorado River water, they say, just in case the negotiations don't work. Alex Hager covers the Colorado River for KUNC in Colorado, and he joins us now with more. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, speaking of water, Arizona's government made a bit of a splash by proposing $3 million for litigation on the Colorado River, even though no one has taken anyone to court yet. What was the reaction to that move?
Well, the reaction is widely that it is not not necessarily serious, but it is not an indication of any further progress towards the Supreme Court. Basically, states across the West say, look, we really want to avoid this going to the Supreme Court. We are actually spending time and money now specifically on avoiding that outcome. And we don't think that we should necessarily be preparing. We should be spending all of our time and energy on avoiding the Supreme Court. So, you know, the reactions so far have been from some people that this is a sign that we should be a little worried, that states may actually be, you know, losing confidence in their ability to come to an agreement among themselves. But other people say, look, this is actually not a sign that we're going to the Supreme Court. Instead, it's a negotiation tactic. It's a sign that Arizona thinks it has the higher hand in these talks.
And why is going to the Supreme Court seen as the quote unquote nuclear option? What is the concern about it reaching that point?
Western water is very complicated. The Colorado River supplies 40 million people across seven states. It supplies 30 federally recognized native tribes, a massive agricultural industry, and it is very carefully subdivided, the water supply. And Western water leaders worry that if they take it to the Supreme Court, they will lose their own autonomy in managing that very complicated system. You know, the people who make decisions about our water in the West are qualified technical experts, people with degrees in water law, people with degrees in hydrology. And they worry that if you send it to the Supreme Court, you're now giving governance power of that very complicated system to a body of people who are not technical experts.
So as all of this brinksmanship unfolds, the situation on the Colorado River is getting worse all the time because of climate change, right? What are the sides saying about that piece of this?
Well, the nice thing about Colorado River negotiations is the states are able to agree on one thing, and that is that the river is much smaller than it used to be due to climate change, and that we need to rein in demand in response. The particulars of how to do that are where we start to lose some of that agreement. So you have states in the Upper Basin, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico, disagreeing with their counterparts in the Lower Basin. That's California, Arizona, and Nevada. And at the heart of that disagreement is, look, we know that climate change is shrinking the amount of water in the river. We just disagree about whose responsibility it is to take less water in response to that.
So one of the other, as you alluded to earlier, very important stakeholders here is the tribal nations. And they'll be a part of this if it ends up in court as well. What are they saying, and where are they on this question?
Well, the tribes have access to a lot of the Colorado River's water. They have the legal rights to it, but a lot of them lack the funding and infrastructure to use their full allotments of water. But because they have those rights, they are very likely to get involved if this goes to the Supreme Court. They may try to seek, you know, they may try to seek more access to funds to develop that water, or, you know, claims to make sure that the water they are owed actually gets to them.
And as all of these differing interests are jockeying for position, when is the next deadline on this?
Right now, the next deadline is in kind of summer 2026, but really action is needed as soon as possible. Like I said, this is a very complicated system. And so to make sure that the water gets divvied up and make sure that any plan the states agree on gets kind of approved, there's just a lot of paperwork. And the lead time for that is pretty long, especially with a federal government that has sowed a lot of confusion and discord. You know, basically, there is no time that would be too soon to come to an agreement. And a lot of onlookers of the river here say that the states really need to get moving faster.
So we started this conversation off by talking about Arizona kind of throwing a grenade here. What has Arizona's response been to the pushback from the other states?
Well, at the end of the day, you know, some of the onlookers here say this is just a negotiation tactic, and Arizona denies that. Arizona's response is basically, look, we're just kind of, you know, covering ourselves here. We understand that if this goes to the Supreme Court, we will need money to fight it. And Arizona's top water leader, Tom Buschatsky, said this is just a backstop in case we don't come to a new collaborative agreement. So they're saying it's kind of just in case and not a sign that things are moving any closer to a court battle, but it definitely ruffled some feathers.
All right. Well, just about 30 seconds left here, Alex. What are the next steps you're watching for? Are the leaders coming back to the table for more negotiations anytime soon?
Well, they are constantly meeting behind closed doors. We don't often know when, and we don't often know what they talk about, but we are eagerly awaiting for some of those closed doors to open and some of the leaders to come out and say, actually, we are willing to give up a little bit of our ideological ground and come closer to something that will end with the river being shared fairly and sustainably.
All right. Well, that is KUNC's Alex Hager joining us, as he often does, to talk about the drip, as it were, of updates on this issue. Alex, thank you so much, as always.
Yeah, always good to be here.
Good morning, and welcome back to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger, coming up, the creator behind the iconic beeps of R2-D2.
You're using sounds that people worldwide connect with certain emotions. That was the breakthrough for robots.
But first, there are a lot more homes for sale in the Phoenix metro area now than at this time last year. Prices, though, do not appear to be coming down. And the data is leaving our next guest with some questions. To talk more about this, our co-host Mark Brody spoke with real estate analyst and agent John Wake, and they started with what he's seeing in terms of the supply of homes in the Valley over the next few months.
Yeah, that's the really interesting thing. Right now, the amount of homes for sale, the supply of homes for sale at this point is 40% more than last year at this time. So that's a big increase. We see this nationally where supply is going up, but Arizona or Phoenix is up towards the top of that list.
Why are there so many more homes for sale now than, you know, in the not too distant past?
Yeah, that's the big question. I looked into it and it's not because there are fewer homes selling. The number of homes that sold so far this year is almost identical to what it was last year and the year before. So the sales haven't gone down, but there's more homes hitting the market. So that's what's causing this. Is so far this year, there's like 19% more homes hitting the market than last year and 33% more homes hitting the market than 2 years ago. So for some reason, not quite sure, more people are willing to sell now.
Do these tend to be existing homes or these new homes? What kinds of homes are these?
The ones I'm looking at are almost all existing homes, not new homes.
Okay. So it's interesting because this kind of goes against the narrative that we keep hearing about how the state needs so many more housing units. And obviously, you know, this is not the number that you know, that policy folks have said. But to say that, you know, supply is up, you know, 40%, that seems like a pretty big number.
Yeah, it is. We're still in the normal range. Like the number we have for sale right now is similar to like 2016, which was pretty much a normal year. But if we went up 40% more from here, that would be at the very high end of a normal kind of a market. So that's the issue. Now, the thing about supply is when I mentioned in 2021 and 2022, where there were so few homes for sale, where people are saying, oh, we need to build more homes. That's the problem. We need more supply. Well, that's the problem. The problem was we had a huge number of investors buy in 2021. In 2021, when this price has skyrocketed the most of any year, the number of people who bought homes to live in actually was lower in 2021 than pre-pandemic in 2019. That wasn't driving the prices up, but the investors, the people who were buying rentals for more than double in 2021, that's what drove the prices up. And that's because the interest rates had gone down so low that's the investors are much more sensitive to interest rates than, you know, first-time home buyer. It was driven by the investors, not by people who are going to live in their homes.
Sure. Do you see the fact that, you know, the supply is so much bigger now than it was? Is mm-hmm. that more a reflection of the fact that the supply was so low before, or the fact that, you know, we're entering this new era of more homes coming on the market, be it either people, you know, looking to sell or, you know, new construction coming online?
Yeah, I think it's mainly the idea that people, for some reason, I still don't know why, are more willing to sell than they were before. What happened? It's like home prices are about the same as they were 2-3 years ago. That's not it. The prices haven't changed much. Interest rates haven't changed much. Back could have been that people were thinking, okay, I'll sell when interest rates come down. Well, they never came down after they went up 2+ years ago. So that's maybe they just decided, okay, I can't wait anymore. I'm going to sell this house. But I still can't figure it out, like what it was. The one thing we do know about the ones that are hitting the market are the normal sized homes, like 1,000 or 2,000 square feet, just the normal homes. When you look like luxury homes, like in PV, actually the number of homes hit the market in PV is lower this year than last. And in Scottsdale, it's only up a little bit. But when you look at the whole metro, just the normal homes, those are the ones that are up like 40% or more.
So would that indicate that for some of those maybe first-time home buyers you mentioned, there might be hope for them in this market?
Well, the bad part is the prices haven't gone down,
right,
but they just have a better selection. So they might have a better selection of homes to choose from. And in that market, for that size range, there's like 50% more homes for sale now than last year at this time. So there's better selection, and maybe you can get a little more negotiating power to get the seller to pay your closing costs or something like that. But it's not a huge amount. If, like I said, if we go up another 40%, then they could have a lot more negotiating power. But I think they would like to see his homes prices to go down. But that's the dilemma we're in right now, Mark. What's worse, prices go down or prices don't go down?
Well, I mean, I guess at what point might prices go down? I mean, at what point does this sort of become a buyer's market where there are enough properties that they can be looking at that they might be able to get, you know, some deals through negotiation?
Well, right now, this is the high season for home sales in Phoenix, and it goes through May. So it'd be really unusual for prices to fall this time of year because this is the high season. But when they tend to fall is in the second half of the year. So in the autumn, prices often fall a little bit. So if we end up getting, let's say this trend continues where we get more and more homes for sale, it probably prices wouldn't change much this first half of the year, but in the second half of the year, you could see a much larger than normal fall in prices in the second half. That's what my guess is at this point.
Do you expect there to continue to be more homes coming on the market? Like, do you expect these kinds of increases to continue into the future?
You know, I don't know, Mark. I can't figure it out. I can't figure out why it's happening now. So I don't know if it'll continue in the future. But it has been kind of a long-term trend over the last couple of years where we're getting more and more homes hitting the market. So I imagine for whatever's driving that, we'll continue into the future.
Well, so given all the questions about what is happening and why it's happening, is it possible to gauge what kind of impact the numbers that you're seeing might be having on the housing market here in the Valley?
It's hard to tell what effect it would have on prices. There's a lot more downward price pressure than upward. Like the prices, upward momentum on prices has been gone for 2-3 years. Prices have been kind of flattish, going up slightly. So that's not driving up prices. But so I think there's a ton more downside risk than upside risk on prices.
And in terms, you mentioned sort of the, you know, the 1,000 to 2,000 square foot homes, are they that are coming on the market? Is it pretty mm-hmm. much, other than say like PV and Scottsdale, is it pretty much evenly distributed across the Valley? Are there places where the supply, the supply is increasing at faster rates than elsewhere?
That's funny, Mark. I was looking into that. There's a couple of oddballs, like Apache Junction is way up and Anthem is way up. But I was thinking of looking at places on the periphery. Like Maricopa is fine. They're like maybe even tighter than Phoenix. But so it's so scattered. I couldn't get really a trend of what's happening, but it's not happening worse on the periphery than it is the inside the metro.
All right. That is realtor and real estate analyst John Wake. John, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
As President Donald Trump attempts to slash the federal government, implement mass deportations, and rid the country of so-called DEI thinking, the protests are starting. We haven't seen anything on the scale of the 2017 Women's March, complete with pink hats and hundreds of thousands of people descending on the Capitol the day after President Trump took office 8 years ago. But we are starting to see opposition to the Trump administration take to the streets. Here in Phoenix on President's Day, we saw around 1,000 people at the Arizona State Capitol protesting a lot of things. And our next guest this morning says that is a problem for their own message. Stephen Richer is a former Republican politician. He served as Maricopa County Recorder until this year. Now, among other things, he is a contributing columnist to the Arizona Republic, and he joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about his take on protests in the new Trump era. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
So, Stephen, let's begin with you here. You say you and these protesters probably have something pretty important in common here to begin with, that you're also not a fan of President Trump, but you have some critiques of their messaging, like beginning with just this big idea here that they should pick one message to focus on, right?
That's right. And this was really born out of a text message that I received from a friend who is also sympathetic to maybe some of the stuff that the protesters are reaching to achieve. And he said, "Why is the left incapable of demonstrating in ways that aren't so self-destructive? Every demonstration today is some medley of every left-wing cause under the sun." And so I wanted to unpack that, and I did some research, and I wrote the subsequent article.
So tell me about that. Like, you wrote this directed to protesters, right? Like saying, I agree with you, but you should do this better. I want to ask you about the reaction you got from that.
Oh, it was, I think some people thought it was reasonable and some people said, "Shut up, you shouldn't tell us how to protest." And that's perfectly acceptable. And of course, protesters can protest in any way that they want. I was writing from an outsider's perspective, offering insight into how they might make themselves more approachable, how they might make their message a little clearer, because the social science suggests that those are important things for a long and effective movement.
You also argue things in the column like they should wave the American flag instead of the Mexican one. We've heard a lot of talk about that. Avoid waving Palestinian flags, which we saw. And also you talk about making sure there's no violence, avoid being a nuisance in general. But then you get into this idea that, you know, laying down in traffic isn't a good idea. Don't wear creepy masks, things like that, you say. When you say approachable, is that the goal of a protest?
Well, I think you want to eventually win over the silent majority, the median American. You want to appear reasonable to the median American so that they won't offhandedly dismiss you as just a bunch of wackos who are upset about everything under the sun.
Let me turn to you, Elvia, and get your take here. What's your impression of what we've seen so far from protests against this administration? I think the Democrats in general in Washington have still sort of been figuring out how they're going to respond. But what do you make of the response on the streets?
Well, in theory, I agree with him and with his column. In practice, no, absolutely not, because, you know, things are pretty confusing right now. And honestly, the protesters right now are doing a lot more than I feel I'm doing myself personally to protest what's happening with the Trump administration. To begin with, there has been an incredibly lack of leadership. And I don't want to say on the left, I will say on the human side. On the humanistic side, the initial protests that I saw were immigrants, I believe, in California, and then spread across the country. And I kept asking myself, who's organizing this? And really no one. So people just incredibly emotional, just taking to the streets because they have had enough, because they're scared, because they have nothing else to do. So when we're writing about don't wave the Mexican flag, don't wear this, don't do that, don't be disruptive, don't do that, you know, that's appealing to the protesters who at this point have almost nothing to lose in the sense, right? So they're just protesting with their emotions.
I wonder this though, Elvia, because as I mentioned, like, we have seen sort of scattered protests here and there. Sometimes they're relatively big, sometimes not. But the big mass response to Trump we saw in 2017 when he first took office, we have not largely seen. Why not?
Because there's so much going on. I mean, people are confused. They are, you know, as Stephen was writing here in the column, I mean, Trump is hitting everyone everywhere. So the protests that we began to see were immigrants protesting, and then were the left, but then where's everyone else? So people are, you know, waking up barely because it's just too much. And then us, you know, sitting here very cozy behind a desk, you know, thinking, oh, wow, gee, why are they doing that? Why are they protesting that? So I think that's why. It's just too much, you know, women's rights, immigrants' rights, federal workers, labor, enough everyone, then you have international issues coming up. So it's just too much. So that's why I think it's very difficult to protest.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you, Stephen. Like, do you think this is partly due to the fact that this is kind of the Trump administration's strategy, it seems, to sort of overwhelm the media, overwhelm the public, overwhelm the other side, whoever that may be, because there's so much to protest. There's so many things happening. No one knows what to focus on.
Absolutely. And I think that is part of the answer to your question about why are we not seeing the same level of protests that we saw in 2017. I think because in part, everyone is overwhelmed. In part, a lot of people are numb and people are tired, and people have been hearing this about Donald Trump for a long time. And I think that there's also a little bit of a perception of, let's give the guy a chance. Now, that's not how I feel about the situation or feel about the president. But I do think from a messaging standpoint, you have to be careful not to cast your group as just anything that Donald Trump touches is bad, and therefore it just should all go away. I don't think that will resonate with the median American, who is the type of person you eventually want to speak to because you presumably want to turn the country in a different direction.
Last question for you both then, which is to broaden that out a little for me. Like, do you think the same applies to the broader Democratic or, you know, opposing response to the Trump administration. Like, we've seen a scattered approach from the Democrats in Washington and Democratic attorney generals across the country sort of filing lawsuits left and right. What do you think this says about how opposition against this administration should look, might look in the future?
I think there's two schools of thought here. One is that the Democrats aren't doing nearly enough and that they need to be facing this down every single day. Mm-hmm. And then there's another school of thought that the Democrats need to pick their battles and they also need to stand for something positive, not just the negative of we don't like Trump, but this is our vision for the country. I don't think that's yet clearly defined for most Americans.
And I think it's right. I mean, I have seen a lack of leadership in that regard, but I think it's because what Stevie was saying earlier applies to the Democrats as well, right? They're overwhelmed. They are flooded. They don't know where to begin. But it's also true that, you know, sooner or later, people are going to get tired of Donald Trump, or when he hits them, when they start hurting, they're going to look for leadership. But not just, I hate Donald Trump, but also, what are you going to do for me? How is this going to look differently, bring some normalcy here? I think that's what they're going to look for, and I'm not seeing it yet.
Okay. All right. We will leave it there for this morning. Editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic, Elvia Diaz, joined by Stephen Richer, former Maricopa County reporter, now contributing columnist to the Republic this morning. Elvia, Stephen, thank you both so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. With tensions in the relationship between the U.S. and Ukraine arguably at an all-time high, this week kicks off a series of pivotal conversations on the international stage about the way forward. Joining us now via Skype to dissect the state of play is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. Rob, I want to start in Germany, where voters went to the polls yesterday in what has been a hotly anticipated election for Germany and for Europe more widely. What do the results tell us, at least as we know them so far?
Well, Sam, there's a guy called Friedrich Merz, and he runs the Christian Democratic Union, the CDU, and he is the one in Germany who has won that snap election. And your listeners may know that the German government collapsed before Christmas, and the socialists of Olaf Scholz are now out of power. And the CDU, the conservatives, the center-right, if you like, in Germany is now back in power. That was kind of expected. The bigger story maybe is that the AfD, which is the far-right party in Germany, they have doubled their showing in the national polls. So they are on about 21%. The CDU, the winners, got about 29%. And that is why the AfD, the far right, are saying, look, one in five Germans voted for us. You need to take notice of what we say over things like migration and other sort of far right issues in Germany. And it'll be remain to be seen just how much the kind of centrist parties that get together to form this governing coalition, how much attention they do give to the AfD. But it's been a very sort of momentous election, parliamentary election in Germany, which has been suffering a lot on the kind of economic front and in its relations with Russia over Ukraine, and indeed now in its relations with Washington as well. Now that the Trump administration have come to power, there's quite a gap, if you like, between quite a few European powers and where Mr. Trump stands.
Well, Rob, speaking of shifting relations with Washington, let's move to Ukraine and Russia, where today marks 3 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What is the latest with that situation, and what can we expect this week?
Remember, of course, that Russia thought this war would all be over in 3 days, not 3 years.
Right.
So this is a total change to what Moscow expected at the beginning. But anyway, we're at 3 years. And what's interesting, significant today, is that a lot of Ukraine's allies have gone to Ukraine today to take part in a summit to mark this three-year anniversary and to really show their support, their kind of concrete support for Ukraine going forward. And of course, that's especially important as the gap widens between Ukraine and Washington. Mr. Trump, of course, President Trump, held that 90-minute conversation with Vladimir Putin. Mr. Trump on the campaign trail, of course, said that he could end the Russia-Ukraine war very quickly. And that's what he's attempting to do. But he's attempting to do it in what seems to be a unilateral kind of way. And that's kind of leaving Ukraine and America's European allies out in the cold. And that is why they have gathered for this summit, to really emphasize that the allies of Ukraine, particularly Europe, Canada, and so on, are speakers one voice on this.
Well, speaking of which, and following on from the situation in Ukraine, both France's leader, Emmanuel Macron, and the UK leader, Keir Starmer, are heading to Washington this week to meet with President Trump. What are the key considerations for each of them around relations with the new president?
If you look at the language coming out of the Elysee Palace in Paris and Downing Street here in London, it's kind of similar. This really centers around support for continuing support for Ukraine. If in the event of a peace agreement, who goes in there to keep the peace? The British have said that they would be prepared to commit troops on the ground. But of course, Mr. Putin has said we don't want any NATO troops keeping the peace in Ukraine. So that's all to be decided. That will certainly be a big talking point for both France and Britain when they go to the US this week. But you're going to see an awful lot of sort of diplomatic language looking to try and ensure that the American relationship with Europe continues in a very sort of friendly and sort of allied way, because at the moment it's not that at all. There's been real disruption since Mr. Trump came to the White House. And so I would say these trips this week, you'll see quite a lot of emollient kind of language to try and sort of indicate that the US and Europe speak with one voice on many issues. But in truth, they don't, especially around Ukraine. And what you're seeing today is solid support from Europe for Ukraine. And that is not the message at the moment you're getting from the Trump White House. And of course, what Trump will say is he'll say, look, I want you, France and Britain, I want you to step up your defense expenditure. Why should the Americans always come in and pay the really hefty bills for security in Europe and security in Ukraine and so on? This is in your backyard. You need to be stepping up and dealing with that more. And certainly here in Britain, we are seeing quite a lot of pressure on that defense budget to going upwards. And so I don't think all the American demands are going to be met. But certainly there is a big move in Europe to spend more on defense. That is certainly true. And it's in response to what Mr. Trump has been asking for.
Well, no shortage of potentially high stakes developments to keep an eye on. The BBC's Rob Hugh Jones keeping us in the loop on this Monday morning. Rob, thank you, as always.
Thanks so much.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. All right. I am about to play you a sound. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I am almost positive that you're going to recognize it. That, of course, is a lightsaber from Star Wars. And that sound alone evokes not just Star Wars, but an entire genre of movies. It is a near universal cultural reference point. But back in the late 70s, when Star Wars was still in development, nobody knew what a lightsaber sounded like. Someone had to invent that sound. And that someone was Ben Burtt, who has since gone on to an Oscar-winning career as a sound designer on films like E.T., WALL-E, and Indiana Jones. Burtt is giving a talk about his career tonight at ASU's Mix Center. And as he told me recently, back in the early days, all he had to go on were his instincts.
When I saw the artwork of the lightsaber on the wall of George Lucas's office, I immediately could hear something in my head.
Could I ask you kind of a weird question? Do you think you could imitate like what that sound was, like just verbally?
Yeah. Okay. I could hear this humming sound, buzzing, you know, dangerous, burning sort of sound.
Uh-huh.
And I had an immediate recollection of the sound that a very specific motor made in the projection booth at the USC Cinema Department, where I was often a projectionist. I was obviously carrying around in my subconscious a connection with many sounds that I had heard over my lifetime and associations with those sounds.
Do you remember any early experiences of that, like maybe even before film school? Like, was sound always something that kind of stuck in your subconscious?
I was in love with music as a toddler. And when music would be played on a record, I would immediately start to react in pantomime stories based on what I was hearing.
What did that look like? Like, you would assume physical characters and...
Yeah, I would become a cowboy riding a horse. I would become someone falling off a cliff, which would be the edge of the couch, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'd ride the ottoman in the living room as if it were a horse, you know?
Uh-huh.
And later, when I started recording television shows off television with my tape recorder, I would play them back and it would bring the whole film to life in my imagination.
Just from the sound of it.
Just from the sound.
Oh, that's interesting.
I got a little older. I got bolder, and I would take my tape recorder to the movie theater, sneak it in a little gym bag or something, and I would try to record the movie.
Would you then sit and listen to the playback of these tapes?
I would spend hours playing back the television shows and movies I recorded. Mm. I'd sit there with headphones on in my bedroom or something, listening to some Western I recorded. And I would just enjoy the movie again. Eventually, I'd start going out, not recording movies or TV shows, but I would go record things in my world around me.
Uh-huh.
And I was one of the few kids that had a tape recorder, because that was a high-tech instrument in 1958.
Yeah, this is not trivial. It's not like now where you can just open the Voice Memos app on your phone. I mean, you had to really carry around what I imagine must have been a fairly bulky physical unit.
It was like moving a microwave around or something. More than that, it was yeah. It was an appliance. But when Sony introduced the first portable recorders in the United States, I think around 1963, 64, my father got me one for Christmas. And that was the fact that I could go portable on batteries with a small reel-to-reel recorder. Really I just opened up a whole world.
Yeah,
and I enjoyed recording outside, taking it to document various experiences mm-hmm. in the neighborhood.
Now, would you sit and listen to that playback as well? I mean, I can imagine, you know, the appeal of sitting and listening to a recording of a TV show or a movie and kind of replaying it in your mind. But would you sit and do the same thing with these more environmental recordings?
Yes, yes. And I got my first clues as to how motion picture sounds were done, the craft of it and to some degree the artistic nature of it. And I was fascinated by that as well, because the language of sounds in movies was teaching the public what things are supposed to sound like.
But that makes me think about something I've heard you say. You know, if we think about R2-D2, I've heard you say that one of the challenges of R2-D2 is that it was one of the first major characters in a movie who didn't have a mouth.
Yeah, right.
Didn't speak in English words.
R2, are you sure this is the right place? It better knock, I suppose.
In thinking it over years later, I realized that probably the closest thing that came to an R2 in the movies I saw growing up were in the Tarzan movies. There was Cheetah, the chimpanzee.
Cheetah, Umgawa. Cheetah, Mukalanda Timba. Umgawa. Umgawa. Umgawa.
Cheetah would communicate, you know, through chirps and groans and verbal, you know, nonverbal sounds. And you pretty much understood what Cheetah was thinking. And it's very much R2 in the sense that you're using sounds that people worldwide connect with certain emotions. That was the breakthrough for robots.
One of my favorite things about the Star Wars movies is that we meet a lot of characters throughout them who communicate in these made-up languages, whether it's aliens or robots. It's always just been cool to me that there's never any subtitles. It strikes me that because of the very human way and culturally associative way that you were approaching this, there almost wasn't a need for them because we just kind of got it based on the tonality that you had this fluency with.
There was a discussion of using subtitles as we were plotting out how to have all these aliens interact. We didn't want to have subtitles because, as George Lucas would put it, it's kind of non-cinematic to do it that way. So we tried to develop sounds that did not require any translation, except for, I think, Greedo in the original Star Wars, because mm-hmm. he has a conversation with Han Solo
right.
that was very specific.
Yeah, but it's the exception and not the, not
it's,
the rule.
It is an exception.
How would you say your process now is different? Do you feel like you use modern tools now to achieve the same effects, or are you still
analog-minded? Yeah. I believe my creative process has not changed very much. My process has almost always been to start with acoustic sounds gathered in the real world somewhere. Motors, vehicles, storms, animals and birds, because the organic real-world sounds are much more successful in creating the illusion that these characters are real because people hear the reality to the sound.
Isn't that interesting?
Fantasy creatures, yeah.
To make people invest in the fantasy, you had to start with reality.
Yes, they recognize them as being having complexity and depth that real sounds have.
Well, Ben Burt is a sound designer, a filmmaker, and a film scholar. And we'll be speaking tonight at the ASU Mix Center at 6:30 p.m. Ben, thank you so much for this conversation.
You're welcome.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.